Hello, All-Star listeners, and welcome to a very special episode of the Veterinary Roundtable presented by All-Star Veterinary Clinic, the podcast where we answer your veterinary-related questions while having some fun along the way. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us a review on your podcast provider of choice, and if you have any feedback to offer to improve the Veterinary Roundtable, let us know. If you have a question, icebreaker, or topic for discussion for the Veterinary Roundtable, send it to Harrison at all-starvet.com. Well, thank you for all those people that have been sending things in, because we now have multiple reviews.
Now, really? Since yes, last episode?
On Spotify. Yeah. We have more than one review.
That's awesome.
I know.
Okay. Great. Thank you. On today's episode, we have myself, Associate Veterinarian Dr. Ashlyn Duckwall, my co-host, my partner in crime, the hostess with the mostest, Dr. Emily King, and our very special guest. He's touted himself as the first veterinary neurologist in the Indianapolis area. He's been a DVM for 16 years and has specialized in neurology and neurosurgery for 12 years. His interests include epilepsy, intervertebral disc disease, tumors of the nervous system, and infectious inflammatory central nervous system diseases. He's one of our greatest colleagues and confidants, Dr. Johnny Cross.
Yes.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yes. Glad to be here.
We're so excited you're here.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I just stumbled upon your podcast on your website. Yeah. And I was like, oh, look at that.
So, and here we are.
Yeah. Here we are.
And see, then you find yourself going down the rabbit hole of like, oh, you're watching all these podcasts. And you're like, what am I doing? It's like, I do veterinary stuff all day.
All day long. Why am I watching?
Yeah, exactly. He's seeing if what we say is accurate.
Exactly.
About neurology.
Yes. Actually, all your comments are just from me. They're actually my aliases. And I just created all.
So. There we go.
There we go. Okay. Now that explains it.
So thank you for your review.
Yeah, thank you. Exactly. All your questions and reviews. Well, we're going to get started with icebreakers.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so if you were a cocktail, which one would you be, Duckwall?
Old fashioned, because it's my favorite.
I knew that you were going to say that, yeah. So I couldn't pick it.
And I'm like old style music, like Frank Sinatra.
With the old fashioned. It's all one thing together.
Oh, yeah. Blues music and old fashioned and a bonfire. I'm happy.
Clearly, you have not had one of those for a while.
I know. So I'm really stressed right now because I can't have one for a while.
Okay. But my question is the old fashions that have the flavored syrup. So like it's like chocolate or orange or.
I've had blackberry and it's really good. I've also had a coffee one around holiday season. That was delicious. But yeah. I mean, the typical old fashioned with a little extra sweetener. I'm good.
That's your favorite.
Yep.
What about you?
I'd probably be an espresso martini. I'm typically a very big coffee person. And I've found that at least there's a large variety in the espressos. Yeah. That some of them are very creamy. Some of them are very straight up and, you know, withhold all that sugary sweet stuff. And you get – so I like the variety there. Yeah. So. And I still need a kick at the end of the night. So,
So you can sleep with after having one. You're one of those people. Okay. Yeah. Now, my little sister, we just did a bachelorette party for her. She wanted an espresso martini tour downtown Indy.
Oh, really?
That's what she drinks all the time. So we just made it up. We just went to bars. But there's a couple of good spots downtown. So
I don't know if I've ever even heard of that.
An espresso martini?
Yeah.
What?
I know. Now I'm because Richie really likes martinis, so now I'm going to have to tell him about this. Okay, he probably knows.
Already. When the baby's out, we're going.
Okay. Mine, I would say, I don't know. I mean, like, if I were a cocktail, I would be a Bloody Mary.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't know why I was expecting some sort of whiskey.
Well, you know, I love whiskey.
Yeah.
But if I was going to be something.
Okay.
Maybe. Yeah.
Just because you're spicy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Spicy, and then it's got a little bit of everything.
Did you know that, and not that this is Bloody Mary, but did you know that tomato juice was founded in French Lick, Indiana?
No.
Yeah, so if you go down to French Lick Casino and you look at the signs outside and you're going around, they have a sign that they were supposed to do orange juice for the guests that were coming one day, some big group. They couldn't find it, and so the chef grabbed all the tomatoes and made tomato juice.
Well,
that's what it says. I don't know if it's true, but that's what
we're going to go with it.
I was going to say
another thing for Indiana.
Yeah. You would think they would make a good, you know,
Bloody Mary. So, I bet they would.
Yeah.
So
another reason to go to French Lick.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. Have you been to French Lick?
I've not.
It's good. It's nice.
It's nice.
Okay. It's like weird because it's like this really nice like hotel, like the. You know, the older one. I think there's two of them
there, right? Yeah, there's the French Lick Casino, and then the other one I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce is either the Baden or the Baden, West Baden.
Yeah, so. And it's just like, you're like, why is this here in the middle of this? Like
in the middle of Indiana.
Yeah. It's because it's not like a metropolitan booming area. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's really fascinating.
Is it for
But the grounds
golfing?
Are really cool.
Isn't there a big golf course?
There's golfing. Yeah. There's some hiking around there too. Oh. They have some trails.
Horseback riding.
Yep. Okay. Sweet.
Bunch of pools.
Sounds
and then,
great.
Of course, they have the casino. I don't know if you gamble or not.
Yeah.
The casino.
I could do a little quarter pole really or whatever those are called.
They got some really good restaurants, too.
Okay, I'm
so
sold.
If you ever need a weekend away.
Well, I won't be here after Thursday, Friday. No, I'm just kidding.
Exactly.
Okay, number two. What's one possession or tool that enhances your daily life?
I'm going to go Vocera for me.
That's a really good call.
Because when we didn't have it for all those months, I wanted to stab my eyes out.
How long have you had it?
Harrison, how long do you think?
5 years. Yeah. It was definitely here when I started.
5 years, maybe.
Before. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do your listeners know what it is, or do you want to tell them what it is?
So Vocera, I don't have mine on. Do you have yours on?
I put it away.
So Vocera is like a little communication badge that you can, it's like a walkie-talkie. You can call people, you know, and when they're in different parts of the clinic. And so I think it must have been, yeah, maybe 5 years ago, we were, one of our goals for the year was to use or find, oh, here we go.
Oh.
It's like, looks like this. use IT devices to improve efficiency and proficiency. And so one of our technician's husbands worked in a hospital. And so this technician knew about these. And so then we just went down the whole path of trying to figure out, you know, will they supply a veterinary hospital and da-da-da-da-da-da. And then it really did change our workflow. It was the one thing that made us a lot faster.
You just got your first sponsorship.
I know, right? There you go, Vocera.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've looked into it a couple times.
Oh, so you guys don't have one.
We do not have it. And we've looked into it and we thought about it. IndyVet on the south side uses it. And I'm talking to Dr. Gillespie, the medical director there. She likes it.
You either love it or hate it, depending on the day, because it's constantly
If it doesn't work, it's a real pain in the rear, but
or people are calling you all the time, but it is so much easier to find people.
Yep, you can say locate so and so or emergency call, and it's like
emergency call, like all veterinarians, you can call all staff, you can even send phone calls through it, you know, so like if a phone call comes in, we don't do that with these, but so it's, we like it. We thought first we're like, okay, is this going to disturb the clients in the room? But then once we used it, and clients are so used to their phones that then it was just, they don't even care.
Yeah.
We don't answer. We have certain rules around the Vocera.
Yeah.
How we answer it. And then, you know, when we answer it, and we can put it on do not disturb, like for an euthanasia or something like that. So there's guidelines and rules to using it, but that's my one thing.
Yep. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
It is. What about you?
My little brother got me into this phone app. It's called, I think it's Habitica or Habitica. I'm not sure which way, but you make up a to-do list, your daily to-do list. You make up some things that are chores that you have to do. It can be, there's three different categories of things. And when you do them, you click the button and you get points. It all adds up to, you can build your little, customize your little figurine person. But it's just a way to gamify your life. Yeah. So get you to do the things that you're supposed to do. So my list might be anything from the obvious things I should be doing, like working out or brushing teeth, or you can make it as detailed as you want, depending on how many points you want to get. Or you can have it do things that you remind yourself to do that are important, you know, give praise to my wife or something like that, or make sure that you hug your kids every day. And you may say, well, why are you gamifying these type of things? But it's just reminders of what, you know, is important. So it's just a fun way to do it. And you can build groups too. And then you can go on adventures to fight little demons and dragons.
Oh, we got to remember that, Harrison.
So, yeah, that sounds cool. That sounds fun.
Yeah, yeah, so, that's really cool.
You know, like most things, I'm sure a year from now, I won't even be using the app. But at least for this time period, for the past 3 or 4 months, I've been using it. And it's helped me in, you know, little things. I don't know. I read lots of self-help books type things, but Atomic Habits and Tiny Habits. I don't know if you've read those two. Two very good books, but you know, trying to make each incremental change in your life very small, because otherwise you'll fail trying to make something too big. So doing something like this just on a micro level.
Yeah.
So. Yes.
Awesome. Oh, I know what
leaders
I'm doing.
Are right. Leaders, yeah. Man. Yeah. Okay.
Crucial Conversations. Crucial have you read that book?
Have you read that one?
Yes.
Have you read Crucial Conversations?
Oh, yeah. They shared it. The leadership of the VCA shared it. They actually gave everybody the book. It was a year or two ago or something, something like that.
Yeah. Our entire leadership team read it. Our doctors read it. So, yeah, it gives everybody common language. You know, it's one of my favorite books. Yeah, extreme ownership. I've got like a whole list of them.
Oh, yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Jocko.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
See, good stuff.
Good stuff.
Well, I mean, honestly, I thought of my toothbrush. I mean, like, no one wants smelly breath. No one wants bad oral care.
That is true.
It does enhance my life.
It does.
Like, my husband appreciates when I have good smelling breath.
Do you have a toothbrush here?
No, I don't.
Oh, so you're not even doing it here. So your at-home family gets the benefit, but everybody here, your coworkers,
that's true. I have coffee breath by the time I'm around here.
So I can smell the wafts as she walks down the hallway. So.
Sometimes I apologize to the dog. I'm like, I'm so sorry. I got coffee breath right now.
Oh gosh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, I mean,
I love it.
Speaking of that, have you ever been able to train your dog to brush its teeth?
No. Like by itself? No. Have you? Please don't tell me you have.
Of course, that's impossible. So. I can't even get my dog to let me do it.
So. Yeah, exactly.
I can't even remember to do it.
Yeah.
Oh.
I can remember once a week. I mean, like, yeah.
Yeah.
With all the kids. Like,
so we understand when the client's like, oh, that's not happening. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
I get it.
I mean, that's, you know, I tell this clients all the time for certain things, but. You know, it's good. I mean, you feel somewhat kind of like a cheat when you're telling clients to do things you very well know that you don't do or not capable of. And I do tell them that. I mean, you know, on a serious note, like I have since I treat dogs with epilepsy, I have a group of clients that are willing to talk to my clients because emotionally it's distressing and all. So they do that and they do something that I can't do, which is I've never had a dog with personal dog with epilepsy.
Yeah.
And so it's one thing to tell a client, give these meds, do this. If you see this, try not to worry, try to, you know, be calm and these things. But I've never had to, one, I have the medical knowledge. So that doesn't, you know, help put myself in their shoes. But the second thing is, you know, they're sitting there watching it and at home and you can't do that. You can't put yourself in their shoes in that situation. So sometimes clients can be helpful. But I tell people, you know, you give this med every 8 hours and I'm like, yeah, that would never happen. Like, my dogs would never get their meds.
That's why I say veterinarians make the worst owners sometimes.
Yeah. My favorite is when I'm like talking about a strict diet for their dog for XYZ. And then I'm like, can I give it peanut butter? And I just slap it on the wall. Like, I'm so sorry. I sound like the crazy aunt.
That's
why
I say we're the bad aunts.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's fine. We got to make it fun.
Oh, jeez. Okay. So let's move on to talking about you. And why don't you start by telling us about yourself? Kind of like what made you pick neurosurgery, kind of just a little lead us down that road of
sure
way back.
Yeah. I mean, start from the very beginning.
The very beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was, born in North Carolina and let's go. But I did grow up small. My father was always in the university life. So we hopped around from university. He went to Mars Hill and then he went to North Carolina, Chapel Hill, NC State, Virginia Tech, and hopped around from these places. But where I grew up was called Cary, North Carolina, which most people know now. It's a very ritzy part of North Carolina. We lived in a trailer. So it was all trailer parks at that time. So it's nothing like what it is now. But then we moved to Virginia, close to where you went to school. And spent most of my life at Virginia Tech and then went to veterinary school at Virginia Tech. And I knew very early on I wanted to specialize in either surgery or neurology. I couldn't decide which one I wanted. But by the time I got into fourth year of school, I knew that neurology was what I liked. I felt that I still really enjoyed the medical aspect. And I'm sure surgeons would hopefully agree with the sentiment. They get to do the medical treatments and things like that. But they move a long way away from that. So at least neurology, being part of the College of Internal Medicine, you still get to do a lot of the medical stuff. And then, of course, you get to do surgery and you get to do a lot of imaging. So I felt it was a specialty that still allowed me to do a lot of different things. You know, you go into internal medicine, you might lose out a lot on the surgical aspect.
Yeah.
So that's how I got there. And then I went to University of Pennsylvania after my internship for my residency, lived in Cherry Hill, New Jersey with my wife and At the time. And then we moved out to Indiana, and I had never been in the Midwest before. I can't even imagine, other than flying through and then driving to Colorado one time in college, I had never spent any time in the Midwest, never even been to Indiana. But there was not a neurologist here. So I mm-hmm. saw that there was a need, saw that that would, you know, be an easy way for me to help out and be busy, because everyone wants to be busy. You don't want to just sit around. You want to have things to do and be able to be productive and active. So that's how I ended up out here. And then I've been with VCA. That was a job I took out of my residency, and I've been with them since. That's very unusual in the veterinary world.
I would agree.
Most, even just general practitioners come and be the same, you know, job for a long time. So,
So did you find like neurology came like easy to you because you were so interested in it? Because I feel like there's some topics in vet med that are like cardiology. It's like one of those things where like, I'm sorry, I have to read this 10 times over. So like, I feel like when you have a special interest, it also becomes just more, one, enjoyable, but two, like just easier to grasp. Do you feel like that happened to you? And so then you knew going forward, you're like, nope, neurology is it? Or
I would not have said I had a special talent for it. I mean, it's possible, but I really am a true believer in that when you find an interest in something, it makes it easier to put in the hours to become good at it. So going back to our books, I mean, if you believe in the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hour rule, then, you know, it's going to take time to, even if you are have a natural ability, you still got to put all in all those hours and everything. So I would not have said I had a natural talent for it. So, but once you start taking that interest, all the people that you know that are gunning for specialty by your fourth year, you know, I had friends that were in opto. So if you had a case, you would go to that friend or something. Yeah. And you all find that here. Like you all even have your own little, you know, specialties among here. That you're like,
niches
oh.
or
you're like, you know, go ask her that because, you know, or, you know, she's scoping all of these things, or no, they're really good with eyes. So,
Yeah. I think that happens slowly over time because people have the interest that, you know, I mean, and so then you get excited about it and go read more and more and more. And
absolutely.
Well, that's for a nice thing. I mean, did you say you're going to have 10?
We'll have 10 veterinarians.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You have to be in a single hospital, the largest single hospital.
I have no idea.
In Indiana. So you may not. Like, oh, click the stats. So,
yeah, exactly.
But I would bet that you are probably have the most veterinarians at non-specialty center. I mean, there are other facilities that have obviously conglomerates of them, but they're all in different areas.
Facilities.
I don't think anyone has 10.
You know, it was a topic of conversation way back, and these guys, as they've come out of school and then, you know, would say, are we going to open up a satellite clinic? You know, and we never really, you know, we kind of just put all of our eggs in one basket, you know, and we felt like that was, with all of us here, we have a lot of brain power. And we can really solve a lot of things for people. And there's a lot of access. I feel like we can give people a lot of access, you know. And so I think that it was just – I mean, because you could take three of us and we could go work over there and then three of us over there and three of us here, you know. But I think also the reason – one of the reasons why I think our – engagement is high and satisfaction is high is probably because we all work together. Mm-hmm. Like, and so the camaraderie and, you know, being around each other and I don't know. What do you think?
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. Like, we're all just one big cohesive unit. And I feel like there's a risk there when you break it up into satellite places, it starts to change the culture, dynamic, how things are run. Cause I mean, every week we have a doctor's meeting and go over things to adjust. So it's just one of those things where, and we're all friends, which also helps too. So it helps make the work environment a lot better. But I feel like we have the special ability to problem solve a lot of things before we go bothering you guys. Cause you guys are already so busy.
Yeah.
Well, then, that's so true. I think the things we bother you with then are truly things that you need to be bothered with. Like, do you know what I mean?
We try.
So it's been, that's what we try anyway. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting cultural shift, the development of specialty medicine, because what it's done in some positive ways is provide an ability for animals to get that high level care, access, and things that they may not get otherwise. And so that's great in some ways, but in some ways for the profession, it's not been good because it's taken a lot of the general practitioners, yes, and they no longer, yes, do things. And mm-hmm, so sometimes we get referred things, and we're always welcome to help out. But sometimes we get things, it's like, this should be something that you all should be doing, not us, you know.
Right.
And yeah, it's not just from a busy standpoint or anything, but it's, you know, it's a baseline level of competency and care. And I mm-hmm think that's been, because you see this more than I do, because I, by the time I'm getting an applicant for a position that I have open, it's somebody who's specialized or something else. But you get probably new grad applicants, and you're asking them what they're capable of doing, and it's like, this should be pretty basic. And, you know, you can see it even when we went through school. You know, I graduated in 2007. You weren't prepared to do any surgery, really. You could do a spay, but that was it. And you flip forward, you know, 10, 15 years before that, they could do basic surgery.
Yeah, we did everything.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, they were teaching us cruciate surgeries. Yep. They were teaching us, wow, I mean, all of that. And it wasn't, you know, but with the, I agree, that's a really interesting point. With the invention of the specialty side of the industry, I mean, you guys have to have work. You know, so then the hospitals or the colleges are like, hey, you know, when you see that, maybe this is what, you know, when you see this, this, and this, you need to send it. I don't know. Is that what they tell you guys?
Absolutely. Like, yeah. I mean, gosh, I've been out 4 years and yeah, I mean, it was spay, neuters. I'm like, yeah, I could do that. Mass removals. Okay, show me how to do the first one first. Like,
yeah,
it's kind of crazy how little on hand technique, everything they teach you surgery wise. I mean, medicine wise is one of those things where, yeah, textbook, and then you just learn with experience too. But I mean, I was, even now still, it's kind of some of these things where cruciate surgery, absolutely not. They never, yeah, sure, they can talk through pictures and how you're supposed to do it, but never would we have ever been hands-on with that to get practice.
Yeah, I remember one of our classmates, when we went to just visit her, my wife and I at the time, she was a class, my wife's a veterinarian too, and in the same class as me. We went to visit one of our friends, and she was telling us about a surgery, a splenectomy she had done. And she had been out only a year, but, and you know, for your listeners and insight into veterinarian, I mean, she literally had the textbook out next to her while doing the surgery.
Yeah.
And like telling someone to flip the page or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure she informed the client, right, hopefully, yes, that was what was occurring.
Right. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's, yeah, she, I mean, but there was no other choice, you know, she had to do it. So, but yeah, that's the kind of level that it's, you know, drained a little bit. So,
well, and I think for those people that are listening, that are students, you know, that are in the schools right now, you know, don't be afraid to, you know, to learn those things, because mm-hmm, I think that, you know, we are capable of doing a lot more than,
yeah, and get a make sure you go to a place with a good mentorship,
yeah,
because that's how you're going to feel more comfortable trying new things, and then from there getting that confidence to do it by yourself too. So I think that's important. But,
you know, one of the things we did was, this was one of our goals from last year, was the cadaver program.
Mm, yeah.
So we started, like, because I was starting to worry that we have so many veterinarians. So then maybe, you know, your more difficult cases, you're only going to see one every so often. So then spread that over then this number of veterinarians that are doing surgery or trying to improve their surgical skills. So then how can we do more of that? And so then we started the cadaver program. So our clients, we call it the All-Star Memorial Education Program, and they donate their pet. And it's a conversation. We, you know, basically drew up the conversation and trained the staff on, you know, and so then they'll donate their pet, and then we can use them as... Mm-hmm. And so that was really, I think that's been really helpful.
Yeah.
So
yeah, for especially if surgery's slow.
Yep. Younger people learning.
Yep.
So what are some of the challenges of being medical director?
Well, at a specialty center, because I'm sure you can comment on this one too. You can leave the room. For a specialty center, like, I am not whatever specialty, I'm not their specialty. And so usually, you know, so I can help, I think, mentor in, you know, client communication, record keeping, you know, other things like that. And we can share a commonality, but I'm not their specialty. So it's difficult for me to advise on certain things, you know, telling a surgeon that this surgery was not, you know, probably the best way to proceed, or telling the internist that, well, why didn't you run this lab or test or anything? That's difficult because, you know, what do I know? Mm-hmm. I just read a textbook that told me that I should do that. So that's difficult. We get support, for things like that, but it's still difficult for them. So that's why a lot of upper management and a lot of places end up being people like criticalists, because they probably have the most variety of ability to counsel the different specialties, except for surgery, of course. But yeah, that's, it's difficult from that standpoint. We also have a ton of doctors. I mean, we have 22 doctors or so. So it's, there's just not enough. You can't mentor that many people and be a full-time doctor.
Yeah. So, that's like, that would so be so hard. Yeah,
that is right. Hard.
So, in, you know, you're going to, I don't know how you divvy this up, but I mean, you can't really, I mean, you're going to be like, no, I can.
Yeah. Watch it.
But you know, you can't.
No, that's true.
People.
Yeah.
Like it,
yeah.
Spending that much time with all of them, like it's, that's difficult.
Yeah.
So if you're truly going to, you know, really do that, it's tough. So, you know, at some point in time, you have to start creating different levels of things. And we do that, you know, with our, like our technical staff, but we haven't done that with our doctor staff yet. So,
yeah.
That's probably one of the more difficult aspects of it. So,
I mean, that's why you have leader. We have a leadership team here, so it kind of helps divvy
scale.
That up
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
Scale right. it, yeah,
yeah, for sure.
Okay, so what brings you the greatest joy when performing your job?
Oh boy, I mean, it's still for me. You know, it's taking paralyzed dogs and making them walk. I mean, that still has to be for neurologists still. It's one of the most common things we do. Epilepsy is the most common thing we do. But it's one of the, just the big joys of watching a dog who's paralyzed and helping them walk again. That still has to be. And then, you know, the clients get to see the progression and you get to recheck those patients too, because sometimes we don't recheck patients all that often because the problem is solved and they go on, but we get to see those patients as they go through rehab and all. So that probably has to be for me, taking the dog that paralyzed walking still.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
That'd be pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be very neat to watch.
I'm always like reading the notes. I'm like, oh yeah. Yeah. Or you see him again after the surgery for annuals and you're like, oh, he looks so good. Yeah. That's cool.
So next question is, how do you work through challenging cases when being the specialist? How do you solve a problem in surgery? Oh yeah, this was one of my questions. It's like, okay, like you're it, right? Like the buck stops with you. So when you're in the middle of something and it's going south, like what do you, because you read books. Yeah. So like, do you have a process?
Oh, let's go to the books.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like what's your process?
Have you read David Goggins' books?
Oh gosh. That's one of his dad's favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a real tough love,
yeah.
So you kind of have to read the first book to somewhat prime you for the second book. The second book is really good.
Yeah. I
so his first book can't hurt me.
Yeah.
But his second book, Never Finish. But in that book, he talks about, I believe it's called the 1 second rule. Mm-hmm. But essentially, and this is coming back into the surgical aspect, you first off set yourself up in a way to hopefully be successful by thinking of all the negative, things that can happen. But you go a step further you think about what are the consequences of making certain decisions. It's a little bit different for, you know, that kind of situation. So in his point is like, if I give up on a race, what will I feel about myself? Other things, you're not going to give up in the middle of surgery and just like, oh, well, this isn't going well. So,
I'm going home.
So being prepared is, so doing that, you know, saying, okay, what are my biggest obstacles? And then thinking about what's going to happen. And the 1 second rule is essentially that you've already prepared for that scenario so that you can react faster. But you're always going to be encountered with things that you're not ready for. And so in that scenario, usually for me, it's just taking a step back. I have the luxury and privilege of working with Dr. Sangster. And so we actually pull each other sometimes into surgery and just say, hey, can I run this? And we talk through it if we're running into problems or something. And our techs are great too. So meaning that the knowledge that they have, sometimes they will, you know, we'll talk, I'll bounce ideas off them. They don't have the same surgical knowledge, but they, you know, they can remember cases or something. So, so talking it through for me would probably be the second part. You know, I could say cursing, But actually, almost all the surgeries that I do, I'm cursing all the time and calling things that I won't share on your podcast because I want you to retain your listeners. But actually, for me, cursing is normal. And so they actually know he's quiet.
Oh no!
Anything. He's like something's wrong. So if I'm quiet and not cursing, so
That's hilarious.
No, that's good. I mean, I think you've definitely taught us that too. Is like, and she said the exact same thing. Go through all the scenarios of negative, what could happen, be prepared, type of thing, and take it as it comes. I mean, that's kind of what medicine is, anyways, right? Like you just kind of take it as it comes because not everything reads the textbook. So, unfortunately. Okay, what's the most interesting case you've encountered? Oh, yeah, this was a good one, too.
Well, I'll tell you about a case. I don't know if it's the most interesting case, but during my residency, so there's a cutaribra. So they we don't see them much in this area. Do you all get to see them some?
We had a slew of two of them in a row that were just in weird spots. But yes.
You know, for your listeners, I mean, obviously when you all typically see them, you know, they create these little holes and then they can actually migrate out the holes. And so they can be in the neck or other regions. But frequently in cats, they typically get up into the nose and they migrate through the nose, through the cribriform plate into the brain, and then they migrate through the brain.
Wow.
And you can, right. So, and this little worm is going along the way, and it creates neurological signs. So in cats, it creates a specific syndrome, ischemic encephalopathy for cats. And so it, because they think, we don't know, but what's happening is it's munching away. It's vomiting, and the vomiting causes vasospasms, and that causes the vessels to constrict and you get ischemic events. Now, if that's what's really happening, we think a famous neurologist up at Cornell, Dr. D, as everyone calls him, you know, studied this for a long time, is one of the key people who helped find it. But so there was this case that we saw the imaging, and you could see the changes in the nasal passages through the cribriform up through the brain.
Oh my God.
And so this in and of itself for us is like, oh, it's really interesting, really neat, but it's not unheard of. But my mentor at the time, like, found, you know, we were tracking it and it's where it stopped. And this patient wasn't doing well. And he's like, let's go in and take it out. And he's like, we're going to take it out. And both my resident mate and I were like, this is insane. This is the craziest idea that I have heard. This is not going to work. But he was just like, he's like, the patient's not doing well. What are you going to do? He's right. Like, so let's go in. So we went in and like, there's like all these people and everything. And I'll go ahead and ruin the story that we didn't see anything.
Right.
So, but, oh my gosh, you know, sometimes the anticipation and the excitement, you're like, oh, there's so many people in the room. And then you get there and you're like, it's not there. And you're not going to go like hacking through the brain just to find it.
Yeah.
But he was convinced. He was like, it's going to be right there on the surface. We're just going to pluck it out. So and I'm like, okay. That would have been so great.
That would have been so cool.
Yeah.
That would be very
cool. But still, that's fascinating how it does that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Just you ever feel robbed? And, you know, because our area, I mean, we get a lot of cool things, but we don't get the infectious stuff they get in the South.
Yeah.
You know, you don't live in California where the infectious stuff or the migrating ons or other stuff. Yeah. Like Indiana, it's kind of like, it is.
Good old Midwest.
It can be boring in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm thankful for it because any neurologist.
Some days, I know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, boring.
Email
isn't
Dr. Carlson.
Isn't always the worst thing, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. But that is fascinating. I knew they migrated, but I never really knew the details of the nervous system stuff. Yeah. So that's a great case.
Yeah,
that's great.
That is a very cool case.
We're gonna get a lot of phone calls now on cast.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
I know, right?
Does my cat have a worm in its brain? Yeah. No, probably not.
They usually do start off with sneezing. I mean, if you actually.
Oh no!
Cats sneeze. That's not great, Cross. Now you got.
Every cat you see now has cutaribra.
Next question. Hurry.
What? Okay, so say the cutaribra is in the brain. You diagnose it. There's nothing to do with it? Are they treating them with?
There's a protocol of treatment that includes ivermectin, and rifoxin, and steroids. we don't know if it works or not. So,
okay.
Usually the worm will die.
Die, okay.
Either by what you've done medically treating it versus it just naturally dying. And then, you know, so the patients can live through it. So,
okay, on this topic, I have to ask. We always say when we have cats coming in for, you know, extensive seizures and stuff, we're always pretty much like, it's usually never a good thing. Is that fair to say you see more epileptic dogs than cats, like, that you manage and stuff?
Well, we see, I mean, I would say 90% of the cases I see are dogs.
Yeah.
I don't see a lot of cats. And I know that's commensurate, not to the same degree, but I don't know. You probably have the statistics on this. You're probably, what, 75% dog and 25% cat, something like that.
Yeah.
See a ton more dogs than cats. But that being said, we used to say, or they used to say before I was a neurologist, that idiopathic epilepsy was pretty rare in cats. Mm-hmm. So the condition that either it's genetic, not genetic, it doesn't really matter, but just unknown cause, seizures. But we used to say that was rare, but I don't think we believe that anymore. So we see a fair amount of cats that actually seizures can be a more benign condition. Mm-hmm. And I think as MRIs become available and we've been able to see that a lot of these patients don't have underlying disease for the most part. Because the difficulty is if you don't have those imaging tools or other things, and you have a patient who has uncontrolled seizures, you know, a lot of clients, they perceive that as a poor quality of life, and understandably so, are not going to continue putting that loved one through that treatment. But if you know it's idiopathic, they might be more willing to do so, especially if there's not an underlying disease process. So the short answer to your question is, I think we know now that it can be a more benign disease in cats these days.
Cool. Yeah. I had to ask.
Yep. No, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. We're already at the last one
cat
here.
Cat seizures are weird, by the way, too.
Yeah.
Comparatively. Dogs and cats both get generalized and partial seizures. But partial seizures are much more common in cats. And, for your listeners, the partial seizures don't activate the entire brain. So consciousness is altered, but it's not. There's not a loss of consciousness in those patients. So they can just be some salivating. They can be hyperventilating. They can have manic behavior, running, sprinting around. Some cats look like they're just going to vomit. But cat seizures are weird. Just everything cats do are weird.
Yeah. Cats are just weird
just
in general.
Own thing.
Yeah.
It almost makes them easier too, though, to some degree. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I used to worry about working up cats, and now I feel like this is totally not going to sound right, but I feel like there's less things that cats can have.
Yeah.
So then I feel like, okay, my differential lists are slightly smaller than
just because they're so weird.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. No, I think it's fair. I mean, that's its own thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is the last one we have. It's been fun, so I'm kind of sad, but what advice would you give to aspiring veterinarians and or technicians?
I've said this not just about veterinarians, but I've said this to other people. It's always, and I didn't do this either, so I could certainly blame myself, but it's surprising to me how little time some people that want to do a profession, veterinarian or whatever it is, actually spend time with the person in that profession outside of whatever they're doing, asking them about what their life is like. Mm-hmm. So, we're in the job with them. We see how it, so you want to be a veterinarian, you got to put so many hours in a clinic and you see what their life is like, but you don't spend time and ask them, okay, so you get home when do you, what do you do? Like, how does this, so you're at home, do you ever work at home or do you ever do email at home? Are you ever bothered by things at home? And maybe it's just impossible to know these kind of questions to ask. But these are basic questions that anyone looking into any profession should say, well, how does this job profession affect your entire life? And I think that is why we get into the problems we do in our profession, because people are not prepared for what it is. And certain people and certain personalities are just not cut out to be veterinarians. They have all the knowledge and all the skills and they can be veterinarians, and they come out and they're very good at obviously diagnosing things, treating it. But the things that make us not want to do the profession, they're not prepared for, and they could have been prepared for if they spent more time. So same thing with technicians. I mean, not just spending time in the clinic learning how to do the things that they do, but say, you know, how does this impact your life? You know, and a big thing, obviously, with that would be just a good example is financially. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of income you're expected to make. How does that impact you? Are you happy with what you do and you found joy because you found that the monetary aspect is not worth it? Great. You know, if you can, you know, deal with that, or you can say, you know, I'm always for wanting more. And you have to decide, you know, that. So, if you're lucky, you'll get that person to take you out to dinner. Because you're a poor student and you don't have money to take the veterinarian out to dinner,
right.
But you spend time with them. But I didn't, as I said, I didn't do this a lot. I spent time in veterinary clinics and also I understood what happened in the clinic, but you don't understand what someone's life is like. So that would be what I would say.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good piece of advice.
The same, and I learned this too from going through your residency, and universities are great. And I was just talking to my surgeon as we were having coffee this morning. You get a good idea of what being that specialist is like, but you are most likely going into private practice. And this is the same thing for you all, actually, too. You learn at a university, it's nothing like being in private practice. So you don't have any concept of what life is like even when you come out. So you think you want to be a neurologist, but I didn't spend, other than my internship, it's not like I was spending a ton of time with private practice neurologists to talk to them about what is life like, you know. Mm-hmm. Does it bother you? Which, you know, I just had a dog last night, paralyzed, so paralyzed, had sensation, and so they're calling you and like, hey, do you want to come in and cut it? I mean, in the general rule, you're like, yes, I do. But at the same time, he's like, well, we've got a full day tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I've got staff, you know, I've got already patients that we've committed to. And so you have limited resources. So you can't know this as a student or something, but it's like, how does that make you feel? It makes you feel terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But yeah, it is what it is. You can't work, you know, 90, 100 hours and, you know, burn both sides of the candle. I don't even know where that phrase comes from.
yeah,
that would be incredibly difficult. I see a candle balancing on both sides. But, you know, and so how does that make you feel? It makes you feel bad because you can't do it all. But
being able to manage those emotions.
Yeah.
Right. So that it doesn't affect other.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I mean, I think that the industry, the turnover is just so... It just seems so dramatic. Like, you know what I mean? Like, where people coming into the field and then leaving the field. And, you know, I mean, I think everything with COVID exacerbated that to some degree, or maybe it just pushed people further, faster. You know, maybe they're already headed there. And then so it just pushed them faster there. But, you know, I think that would do a lot to keep people from entering maybe a field, or at least maybe developing skills to know how to manage those feelings. You know, because I feel like that's another thing. I don't feel like, you know, in school, you don't learn enough about, you know, there is no life coaching. There is no, you know, to help you figure out skills to be able to do those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, we had a patient, it was a couple weeks ago. One of the other doctors had a patient who was under anesthesia and they lost it and got it back. And that's great. But the trauma to the technician, this technician the next day had to do anesthesia. So what kind of personality do you have? Because there are some people who are like, they don't recover that fast.
Mm-hmm.
And this technician did. And so obviously she's in a profession that's good for her. But there's a lot of people, it's like, have you ever had to deal with that? Do you, you know, how do you deal with that kind of situation? So that's tough. So
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a great point of just like understanding there's so many elements to this profession. It's not just playing with puppies and kittens. It's not just, you know, doing a quick exam and vaccines. You have people attached to these pets. You have life outside, your family. Like, how is it going to impact going through vet school, even like your spouse or your family, your lack of social time, things like that too. So, I mean, you're like asking those questions, not just like, oh, what are you doing over there on that patient? No, like ask more broad impacting things. So, and also I feel like the first year you just don't know what you're doing out. At least I felt this way. I didn't know what I was doing at all outside of school that first year. So giving yourself grace that like, it's not always going to be as hard. It's still a hard job, but If you have the right mindset, personality, determination, things, it does get better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember coming out of my residency and I cut so many backs during my residency, and I came out and I was by myself and finished the CT. Cause before we moved in the new building, I had CT. And I felt like I was literally looking around like, who do I ask about, make sure this is the right place? Like, right, I'm cutting this, right? Like, this is the site. There's nobody else there.
It's just you, know,
just me. Yeah. So you don't, you know, you're not ready for that when you come out, you know, and, for students these days, they come out and they think, and I'm sure you all are pretty good here. I don't know what your appointment schedule is, but probably 30 minutes or maybe even more for a puppy, new puppy or something. But, you know, probably 30-minute appointment. Could be 20 minutes. That's still pretty standard. But, you know, you come out of vet school and you think appointments are an hour long. And then you go into private practice and they're like, yeah, I want you to see an appointment every 30 minutes. And they say, yes, I'll ease you into it. So for a month, they let you see an hour appointment. And they're like, now I need you to see some stuff. That's
right. So, yeah. Now and I'm still paying you and you need to.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yep. That's true. Yeah, a lot of different moments.
Yeah. Was that a little PTSD for you?
Like, yeah, she's like, oh my God, I remember.
No, thankfully I...
it's been far enough now.
It's been far enough now. Yeah, yeah. Come a long way. Let's put it that way.
You've done amazing.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so before we close, because you mentioned books, tell us what your favorite, like, top three books for leadership, and then, like, or for one for leadership. Do you have one for leadership that you really like?
Leadership. No, not really for leadership. I mean, I can't really say. I honestly, the new Never Finished book by David Goggins is a really good book.
Okay.
And I already mentioned it earlier, but Atomic Habits is a really, really good book as well. I just enjoy how you can try to improve and, you know, through small steps and increments and try to break your life down. In that way. So those would probably be my top two right now. So
cool.
Right, what are yours?
Oh gosh. I mean, I love reading about leadership, but one of them is Leaders Eat Last by Simon Sinek.
Yeah.
Is really good at just explaining the thinking behind the type of leader that, you know, you want to be in terms of putting people first and building a culture that promotes safety, you know, and people being involved. And I'd say Crucial Conversations is by far one of my favorite books. I just think
it's really good.
It really helps people when you're talking about working with all women, you know, I mean, and building a culture where people feel safe and people feel valued and appreciated. I mean, and trying to prevent stories from building up in people's heads, it is invaluable. You know, I feel like it's really propelled us, you know, to a different place comparing us to other small practices.
Yeah.
Or general practices. So
yeah, we ain't small anymore.
I know. Yeah. The days of small Rome. Well, listen, we really appreciate your time tonight. Yeah. You're one of our most favorite people to talk to. You're always helpful. You're always willing to get on the phone. You make us better. Mm-hmm. And we do read your reports because we will send people and be like, I'm stealing the information from that report. Yeah. So we have, you know, we'll know what you did with this particular patient. And so it is really helpful. Mm-hmm. But and the rest of your staff there, you know, Vecchio is amazing. You know, I can text him at any time and he's like, yep, do that. No, don't do that. And so we really appreciate your guys' support. Like I said, it really does make us better.
Going back to question, what's one possession or tool or person that enhances your daily life?
That's right. Cross. Exactly. Yeah. Dr. Cross is like, oh,
I can email him.
You
he'll
know,
help.
I'll be honored, but you just call me a tool.
That's why I said person. That's why I was like, person. No, never. I'm so sorry.
We know you're busy, so thank you for hanging out with us. All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Veterinary Roundtable. Remember, send in those questions and be sure to follow us on all social media platforms at All Star Veterinary Clinic. If you enjoyed this episode or a previous episode, leave us a review on your podcast provider of choice. We'll see you in a few weeks for the next episode of the Veterinary Roundtable.
Sounds good.
That's a wrap.